This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
2nd at 6 p.m. at the SEIU Local 49 location at 3536 Southeast 26th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. And they're going to serve a light dinner. So if you want to come and talk about advocating or find out more information about those topics, you can just show up. And the number is 503-236-5573, or you can email marco@jwjpdx.org. So those are the announcements I have. Do you guys have any announcements you'd like to share with anything going on?
No.
Okay.
No, let's roll.
Let's roll into our new and upcoming conference. Susan Stoner would like to tell us a few details about the conference. What would you like to share with us, Susan?
Well, the conference starts officially this coming Friday evening, and it's going to be starting at 5:30. There's going to be a registration, and it'll be at the Oregon Historical Society. They have kindly opened their building to us, and we'll be having a reception, and also people will be able to tour the different exhibits that are going to be there. So, and then there'll be music, and basically it's a getting to know you, have a good time kind of thing with a lot of people from around Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. And then in the afternoon, or in the next day, on Saturday and Sunday, it's going to be at the University Place Hotel and Conference Center, 310 Southwest Lincoln in Portland.
It's right up by Portland State.
Yes.
In fact, it is part of Portland State.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of workshops and different variety of things. People are coming from as far away as Canada in order to do presentations. And it's usually a really good event, and I think it's a real unifying event for people to hear about our shared history and realize how much we have in common.
Right. Michael, were you aware of this organization before you became affiliated with us?
I was not, but I must say I'm pretty excited about this conference. I will be at OEA meetings Friday evening and all day Saturday. However, I'm planning on coming on Sunday morning at 9:30, and then at 11 o'clock, there are two different groups of panels. Pointing this out because these were of interest to me. We had Mike Monk on the show last time, and he talked about, you know, labor history, and we had callers calling in who knew a whole lot more than I did about that. But one of the Sunday mornings at 9:30 is a panel called Memory and the IWW and Centralia, and that one looks interesting. The one I might actually attend, though, is one called Emergent Mass Movements and Labor, Lessons from Occupy. So that one's very timely.
Right.
And then that's the early morning series, and there are three of those. And then at 11, one that I'm interested in is a roundtable, which is going to be moderated by our very own Elaine. And that one is titled Young Workers and Labor Activism. And being an AFT member, in fact, I'll pat myself on the back. I was just elected treasurer of state AFT.
We were going to talk about that.
Were we going to talk about that? Well, we don't need to. but our organization has a number of younger folks in it, obviously, because we have graduate students from the U of O and OSU, two moderately recent and very recent locals, which are fairly large locals. So I've communicated to those folks and invited them. If they want to drive up for that, they would be certainly welcome to come and sit in on that particular panel, which ought to be of interest to a lot of our younger folks.
Right. I am not moderating that. As a matter of fact, I managed to delegate that to Amy Hirschfeld. She volunteered to do that. So she'll be doing the introductions, but I'll be there.
Good to know.
I did line up a lot of the speakers, and it should be a very interesting roundtable because they're young people from different walks. We have one young gentleman from PSU that is a history major and knew, as he put it, a few things about labor history. So by attending this, he may know more.
Excellent.
But, of course, he's a student and has been an activist, so his experiences will be greatly improved the roundtable that we have. Mm-hmm. And I think you're moderating one, though, aren't you, Susan?
I don't think I'm moderating. I think I'm a part of a panel on oral history.
Oh, yes.
And part of the reason for that is that I was a subject that's how I got involved in the organization, is I actually was part of a project to get oral history of people and lawyers in particular in labor, get their history and why they're involved. So
maybe this is a good time to explain just exactly who you are, Ms. Stoner. Oh. You are a labor lawyer for the, go ahead and tell me.
Oh, Amalgamated Transit Union here in Portland. Mm-hmm. I've actually been working for them since 1988, but I became in-house counsel in 1992. And so that's kind of what I've been doing for a long time now.
Give us a little background about how you got involved with unions and eventually going into law school and that sort
of
thing.
Well, when I came out of high school, I became a hippie. And
became?
Yeah. And a wonderful experience. But then I moved on into anti-war movement and into community organizing issues here in Portland. And one of the very first sort of political acts that I did was a labor strike at the Fry Roofing. And it was a real eye-opener. And I wanted to, when I then later went to law school, I pretty much knew I wanted to get involved as a labor lawyer. And even though I was in Houston, Texas, I was also working for the University of Houston, and I noticed that there was a real need for a voice for labor, an advocate for labor. So,
were you able to take studies in law school that prepared you for the labor work that you do now?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we had a very good labor professor there. And so I felt like in fact, we had a couple. We had another guy who specialized in OSHA and employment rights and things like that. So oddly enough, the University of Houston, although it was very oil and gas oriented, had a fairly good department.
That's good to know. Wow. Yeah. All right. Thank you. And so we have you now working here locally with the bus drivers and other
yes.
people that work at the TriMet, right?
We actually represent workers at 17 different employers. The only one you ever hear about is TriMet because it's a management. They march to a different drummer than the other management teams with the other employers. So
What are some of the other businesses and workers that you represent?
Well, Salem Transit, basically every transit district in Oregon, plus ones in Washington, in Walla Walla, and in Vancouver. But we have a more congenial working relationship with them.
Ah, okay. We don't want to go into too much difficulty here, do we?
No.
Thank you for sharing all that information. So you must have been about in your 20s when you made that big decision. How long did you decide to stay a hippie before you moved into activism?
Oh, I didn't go to school full time. I didn't graduate from law school till I was 37. So I did a lot of different things. I did prisoners advocacy. I did I started women's clinics. I worked at Outside In.
In Portland?
Yes. I did a lot of things like that. And then I also went and lived in the South for 9 years. So
what took you to was that when you were in law school?
I ended up going to law school because I basically got a full scholarship to do it.
Very nice. Well, we're glad you came back and stayed.
Oh, you couldn't have kept me away.
Michael, do you have any questions about her writing career?
I have a ton of questions.
Okay,
As an aspiring writer myself. But before we do that, I'm guessing there are folks at home right now who are asking the question, gee, this is the first I've heard of the conference coming up this weekend. How do I find out more about it? And I'm not sure we've given them that information
You're
yet.
You're right. We have not, because I figured we'd jump around and forget to wrap it up later.
Ah.
So if you're interested, if you look on, there's a website, and you also can just show up. You can show up. You won't be able to get any food if you just show up without previous arrangements, but we would be glad to welcome you. Our website is Pacific Northwest Labor History Association. You plug that into your computer and up pops us, and it has all the information on the conference as well as how to register and all of those information. So we'd love to have people just drift in, check it out, pay your fees, attend some workshops.
And for a conference, having attended many myself, the fees are very affordable.
Mm-hmm. That's right. They run about Oh, $85 for registration for all 3 days. And if you're a student or unemployed, it drops it down to $25. And we were really trying to encourage some students to come and attend and see what this is all about.
Find out about labor history. Right. Speaking of labor history. As long as we've got Susan here, this is a woman who's cranked out 3 books in just a few years and is working on a fourth.
And a fifth.
And a fifth.
Yeah, I've got the fourth one done.
Having to do with a particular character at the turn of the century, last century, Portland, circa 1902, and all that was happening around the development of the city of Portland. And I have to say, I've read the first book, which is called Timber Beasts, and I'm halfway through the third. I had to read them out of sequence because I knew we were talking about your third book today. So, but I've only lived in Portland 23 years, and it is just amazing finding out all of the bits and pieces that you've included in these. I mean, they're essentially labor-oriented murder mysteries, and they're sort of fiction, and they read well. I'm enjoying them. I read a lot of fiction, and I've got my list of authors that I love to read, but I'm happy to include these as well. And it's made doubly interesting by finding out about the current one I'm reading, Dry Rot, is about turn of the century. We didn't have what we have now in terms of infrastructure. So I live off Hawthorne. We didn't have a paved Hawthorne running all the way from downtown to Mount Tabor. Okay? We had dirt roads, and we had floods, and we had gullies, and we had, so if you were going to get around, you had trestles over everything.
That's what really surprised me.
Yeah.
It's not just the bridges across the Willamette.
Right.
It's like from neighborhood to neighborhood.
And over swamps along the river.
So, yeah. I'm driving up and down I-5 now, and every time I go over the new construction on I-5, I will look uphill at that trestle and say to myself, that's what all of Portland looked like.
Right, wooden trestles.
Turn of the last century. So I appreciate that about the books and want to thank you for that.
And, of course, the title is Dry Rot, which could let you know that maybe something's going wrong with those wooden trestles. Would you like to elaborate about what happens with the wooden trestles?
Well, what happened, sort of how this came about, is I go to the Oregon Historical Society Library, and that's a wonderful place to go. And I was reading newspaper, and they talked about in October of 1902, bridges that started falling down all over the city. And so what I did is I sort of spun off of that a story about why were the bridges falling down, and it has to do with the concept of corruption.
Corruption and?
Honest corruption and dishonest corruption.
And corrosion. You are listening to KBOO 90.7, and today we are talking with Susan Stoner about a conference that's coming up this weekend for the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, as well as some of the books that she's written. And I know for a fact that you're an excellent researcher, and you spend a lot of time at the Oregon Historical Society. So, Michael, you want to ask some more questions about her book?
Well,
you've got things marked
I've
pages turned.
You know, it's the curse of being an academic, especially somebody out of sociology. So you're always trying to link up what you're reading about that happened in the past with what's happening these days. So I was reading a passage here in Dry Rot where the protagonist, who is a secret union supporter.
Operative.
Helps folks
Sage
out.
Adair. What a great name.
Sage Adair. So because of nefarious work by a contractor who did not do a good job with the trestles. A trestle collapsed as a fire crew was going to put out a fire. It collapsed. The fire engine fell into the gully, and a woman and a child were burned up in the fire. So, Mr. Adair is sort of ranting about that, and indulge me for a second. He says, Mackey squeezes the workers out of decent pay and hours. He squeezes the city taxpayer, Mackey being the contractor,
right,
by doing shoddy jobs, and now it looks like his greed has even squeezed the life out of innocent people, including the poor mother and child who died in the house fire. And I read that, and I thought, huh. We just had an incident happen in West Comet, Texas, where a fertilizer plant blew up. Because Texas, and it's interesting you come out of Houston, Texas is like a libertarian paradise. No regulations anywhere, ever. No inspectors inspecting.
No zoning codes.
Right. So when that happens, we can obviously see that bad things happen as a result of that. So we have, you know, a fertilizer plant blow up in West Cama, Texas. And we had 110 years ago, we had trestles collapsing here in Oregon for the same reason.
You're right, and I think the fact that you mentioned the whole libertarian concept of big government is bad, I think we need to start talking about that because basically countering it, because I don't know about you, but I want government to think about my health and safety, and I want them to enforce it. One of the things about Houston and their lack of codes is they'd build a house and the darn thing would fall apart in 10 years. And when I was there, they had an entire apartment complex. It was no more than 10 years old. They had to tear down because it was just so shoddy. And the same thing with workers. I mean, people died in order to get good health and safety regulations. And over the years, those are starting, you know, either through underfunding, which is an aspect of the book that I wrote. In Portland, what happened is those trestles were built in order for land developers to sell the land plots. As soon as they sold it, they then worked and put all their money to repealing the taxes that they used to build those bridges to the land they wanted to sell. So that we had an influx of like quadrupled our population and in a very short amount of time, but the city budget actually got cut. And that is the same kind of mentality that all of a sudden money goes to the whole concept of, oh, big government's bad. Well, big government is us collectively and what we collectively decide we need to actually stop greed from metastasizing and taking over in our country. Mm-hmm. And that way the parallels are so clear, and that's why I picked this time frame, is that progressives in the early 1900s were beginning to demand that government step in and try to control greed and the consolidation of power. And now that's exactly where we are. Same mm-hmm. thing, only this time, instead of on a national level, it's on a worldwide basis of, you know, the whole global corporate mentality. Mm-hmm. And you see it also, I have to say, permeating our public agencies, that same mentality.
The school systems, and you build the bridge so you can get the revenue, and then you don't upkeep the bridge.
Yeah.
Let it fall apart because it's somebody else's problem.
Indeed. Mr. Romney earns that $20 million a year that it appears in his mailbox, and by God, he shouldn't have to pay any taxes on it so that we can use that money to do things like, oh, repair bridges over the Mississippi River in Minneapolis.
Or
exactly.
Selwood.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Or Selwood. Right.
Exactly.
What were some of the things that you, when you were doing your research, that you bumped into that you really, it almost set you on a tangent from what you were looking for? Were there things like that came up?
Wow. My problem is I'm now off in Central Oregon.
Oh, yay, my hometown.
in book number 5, and between that is one about Teddy Roosevelt coming. So if you don't mind, I'll answer it sort of currently, the thing. The thing that I found astonishing is that when they had a Labor Day parade in Le Grand and in Baker, they had over 5,000 people in each town come out for the parade. Labor was very big in those two towns.
In Eastern Oregon.
And that was a real surprise to me. The head of the AFL-CIO went from Portland and traveled all over Eastern Oregon attempting to sort of gin up support for the idea of labor unions. And so that was a real interesting thing. I didn't know that they actually had a labor history in Eastern Oregon.
It's kind of dissipated in the meantime.
I think so. It was focused a lot on miners and railroad people and stuff like that. So I think, yeah, it's not as strong.
The nature of work changed in the area.
Yeah, sort of like shipping our factories overseas.
Right.
Right. Well, I think, Michael, you said that you didn't want to talk too much about your role in AFT, which is American Federation of Teachers. But you were at a conference and you were elected the treasurer?
I was at our convention. Yes,
convention.
I was 3 weeks ago. Yeah, we had ours roughly 3 weeks ago, AFT, and then the state affiliate of the NEA had theirs 2 weeks ago. So, yeah, we go back to back.
And you're going to do big things with that money, right?
Well, again, I ran on a platform of union members pay dues. And sometimes they know where those dues go, and sometimes they don't. Roughly, of our affiliate at Portland Community College, AFT 2277, roughly 50% of each person's monthly dues goes to the state organization. And when I was president of that affiliate recently, I would have members ask me, well, where's that going? What am I buying with that half of my dues? And when I discovered I couldn't give them a good answer, I thought, well, I go back to the three W's. You know, when there's a problem, you can do one of three things. You can whine about it, you can walk away, or you can get to work. So I thought, well, maybe I better find out more about it. And then as I did, some folks may know that we have just organized the faculty at the University of Oregon. It's difficult to organize college faculty because they regard themselves as professionals. They don't believe they need a union. By God, they're, you know, they have all kinds of degrees and they can bargain the wages they deserve. Well, turns out they can't. Anybody who knows what's going on in higher education knows that it's basically being commercialized and
corporatized
and
part-time with no benefits
and part-timeized. When I mean, I was in you know, PhD programs in the 80s, and we were hearing at that point that all those old people were going to retire soon and there would be a whole lot of tenure track jobs opening up. It's a good time to be in a PhD program. And of course, that's not what happened because of financial and other considerations. People retired as full professors and they were replaced by part-timers because it's
two or three part-timers.
Less expensive to do. Two or three part-timers. So at any rate, what I hope to do as treasurer of the state organization is spend more time working with individual locals, individual members, having them appreciate that when they pay their dues, however much money that is, that's X number of hours per month that they are working for the union. So it's not a piece that's taken out of your check. It's hours that you put into your union. And here's what those hours are buying you. So I kind of want to take this lemon, which is having to pay dues, and turn it into lemonade, which is to help members understand that contribution is really, really important to the labor movement, locally, statewide, nationally, and they are putting in some time every month, whether or not they volunteer for their union. They are volunteering for their union when they pay their dues. And since they're doing that anyway, they can also volunteer by doing this and doing that, participating in campaigns and, you know, thinking about running for office, recruiting people, finding out more about unions and why they're important.
I think the thing I find most amazing about unions, besides the fact I think they're the most democratic institution that we have in this country, the other thing I find amazing is that collectively the group is so much more creative and they come up with a collection of information and experience that when you finally do get together and you try to problem solve, I think you have such a wealth there that it's an exciting thing to be part of.
And that's been my experience with working with other union members in, you know, whatever capacity. I was the editor of a newsletter, and so I would have to interview people for the newsletter, and it was always so interesting to find out different takes on the same problem.
Mm-hmm. Everyone has a voice, and those voices are honored and respected. And AFT, because we have different components. We have community college folks. We have four-year college folks. We have K-12 folks. We have classified, part-time, full-time. There's an interesting range, as many unions are in the development of unions in the 21st century, as many unions are. We are broadening our tent, widening our tent, so we're including more people. And because of that, we have more perspectives and more voices, which is very, very useful. All educators, but all kinds of voices.
Right. And I'm always happy to hear what's going on with the education community when you're here on the fifth Monday, which falls for us about four times a year. So I think that's...
On that vein, I should point out to folks that if you are going to register for the election that happens later next month, 21st of May, it's an election nobody knows about because we're not electing any major candidate for anything. But we are, however, electing board members for various boards. And there are four or five measures on the ballot which would assist different school districts in this area. Beaverton's got a big levy out there. So you need to be registered 21 days before the election. So you have until, if you register online at OregonVotes.gov, you have until midnight tomorrow to get registered for that election coming up in 3 weeks.
And the voters' pamphlet's quite thick. So there's a lot of issues going on. We got that in the mail, and I thought, this unknown election looks like it's got a lot of meat to it.
Half of it is about fluoride.
Fluoride. Yes. Yes. Well, I think the one other thing I'd like to make known is that this new book that you have, Dry Rot, is coming out in June?
Yes.
And what kind of schedule are you going to have being here and there and everywhere with that book?
Well, for sure, Powell's at Hawthorne, I believe, on the 13th of June. And then there's a date, Costco Tigard, I'm going to be doing a book signing.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to seeing you around and about, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And next week, we will have another Labor Radio show from 6 to 6:30, as we do every Monday on KBOO. Thank you very much, and we'll close out with a good night and solidarity forever.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Susan. Good night.
Thank you.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
And in our hands is placed the power, greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of armies, magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
KBOO Community Radio continues the broadcast of the 2013 ILAHI Lecture Series on Wednesday, May 8th, when we'll broadcast a talk by Jeffrey Clements.
An attorney and author, Jeffrey Clements is the co-founder of Free Speech for People, a national, nonpartisan campaign challenge, the creation of constitutional rights for corporations, overturn Citizens United versus FEC, and strengthen American democracy and self-government. Clements is the author of Corporations Are Not People.
Jeffrey Clements will be speaking at the First Congregational Church in Portland, and KBOO will broadcast the talk live at 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 8th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/ILAHI2013.
Sometimes you see that I'm mad. Don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Karen James. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. 93% of Oregon's prison population return to their communities at some point. Those returning include people convicted of a sex crime. According to the Oregon State Police, there are over 19,000 registered sex offenders in Oregon. Of these, 4% are highest risk to reoffend and are posted to the state police website. Many people convicted of a sexual offense want to change their behaviors, and they seek treatment in our communities. My guest is Janine Mano. Janine is both a licensed professional counselor and a certified clinical sex offender therapist. Welcome, Janine.
Thank you, Karen.
So, Janine, tell us about yourself.
Well, I've been working in helping relationships since 1997. I've had practices that offer children and family therapy, and then since 2003, I have started my own group practice working with sexual offenders and all of the systems in which they are involved, including their families, schools, churches. Whole Systems Counseling and Consultation is the name of our business. The treatment we provide is what is considered evidence-based, meaning all the treatment that we provide needs to be supported by research that indicates what would lower the recidivism or reoffense for people who've been committed a sexual offense.
How do sex offenders come to your clinic?
They're either released from prison with conditions that mandate them to treatment or to what's called a psychosexual evaluation to determine if treatment is needed. Some clients write me from prison. Sometimes family members contact me directly to get their loved one in treatment. Oftentimes as well, if they don't go to prison and they are on probation, they as well most will have a mandate at the PO's discretion.
And probation means that they are still in the community but receiving treatment. Is that correct?
That's correct. And probation is considered probation. How well are you going to do in the community? And we're in direct contact with the probation and parole officers, and we need to report whether or not they actually are involved in treatment and getting it.
And which counties are you working with?
Right now, we work mostly with Clackamas County and Multnomah County. Every once in a while, we might work with someone in Washington County. And in addition to the probation and parole, some from Oregon State Hospital, it really depends. They could be convicted of a sexual offense. There's many who are guilty but insane.
And what do you mean their recidivism rate goes down?
The baseline of reoffense for sexual offenders is lower than other crimes. It's actually much lower than I think people realize. And it depends on the type of offense that occurs. But with treatment, say you start with a 10% reoffense rate, that 10% can be cut down by 40% with treatment. I'm speaking right now with research I know about adult offenders.
So, Janine Mano, talk about whole systems approach.
The whole systems approach was the design of the program to begin with, and that comes a little bit from my background in working in nonprofits that involved the family voice in mental health treatment, as well as one of my master's degrees in a systems theory or interdisciplinary type of approach to helping people. And that means the community getting involved as much as possible in the treatment of people who have been affected by sexual abuse, including the actual offender. So a whole system standpoint means that imagine everyone who's been impacted by sexual